Hello, welcome to The Signal. I'm Drew McConnell.
And I'm Sarah Trimeles. We're with the audio workshop at the University of King's College School of Journalism.
Today on the show, Nova Scotia's plan for in-person school has some worried about COVID exposure.
If you're just counting on people to have this intuitive sense that, oh, I think I might be without symptoms, that's going to drive spread because of what we know about how Omicron acts.
And a Cole Harbour father worries about the future of his kids' daycare.
The relationships we built at that one daycare, I can imagine there's thousands of families who built very similar relationships where they are.
We'll hear about the fallout from the Canada-wide agreement to reduce daycare costs.
And we'll go deep on a new report on defunding police in Halifax.
If we really want to drill down to the kind of core ethic of this report, it's that we have faith in our community that we can keep each other safe.
A feature interview with Tari Ajadi, one of the lead authors of that report.
Plus later, why it's time for more action on Alzheimer's.
If every year we're increasing unprecedented levels, the number of people between the ages of 75 and 90, we will have unprecedented levels of dementia. That's a fact.
In the wake of Alexa McDonough's death, I'll look at the devastating effects dementia and Alzheimer's have on the healthcare system. All that and more on today's show.
Many parents and teachers are worried about a lack of COVID contact tracing in schools now that kids are back in class. One group of parents took matters into their own hands. Nova Scotia Parents for Public Education created a public spreadsheet to allow families to do their own tracking. But the province isn't planning any changes.
Premier of the province of Nova Scotia and Dr. Robert...
Premier Tim Houston and Dr. Robert Strang didn't mince words during this week's COVID briefing.
Apparently there's still confusion around contact tracing. So to be very clear, nobody is restricted from telling anyone that they have COVID. If you have COVID, you can tell whoever you want that you have COVID.
But many are worried about the lack of systematic case reporting. Paul Wozni is the president of the Nova Scotia Teachers Union. To him, it's a big mistake.
By not providing parents and staff and students with notifications about positive cases in an anonymous way, it really impedes the ability of parents and students and staff to follow the public health advice that we know is needed to help minimize the spread if you're exposed.
For Dr. Strang, the high infection rate of the Omicron variant has made contact tracing in schools unnecessary. He called for parents and teachers to focus on the COVID protocols that already exist, such as masking and improved ventilation.
We can't equate safety with being COVID-free. In school or anywhere in our province, COVID is everywhere, so of course it will be in our schools. We can, however, consider the multiple layers of safety in place at schools, and that these are layers that are not in place at many other places in our community.
Houston said keeping track of COVID exposure has become a personal responsibility.
And they shouldn't rely on contact tracing or exposure notifications from the government or from anyone else to manage their own health. This is the time to take responsibility for your own healthcare status as much as you can. This is this time to support one another. That's the blue-noser way.
For Wozni, the lack of contact tracing is exactly what makes taking personal responsibility difficult. He says students and parents can't effectively self-isolate in response to COVID if they are never aware of an exposure.
If the only time that you do that is when you're symptomatic, you know, there's data that shows that Omicron can be in your system for 10 days before symptoms occur. And that's the struggle that we have, you know, that if people have been exposed, they're positive and they're asymptomatic, and they don't get advised that they should be self-isolating and getting tested. We could have people in school for 2 full weeks, COVID positive. If you're just counting on people to have this intuitive sense that, oh, I think I might be without symptoms, that's going to drive spread because of what we know about how Omicron acts.
Provincial and federal public health officials both say that the best protection for kids in schools is for them to be vaccinated.
Special thanks to John Marshall for that report. In Dartmouth, Prince Andrew High School is looking for a new name. Students and community members have been calling for a name change since 2019. That's when Prince Andrew was accused of sexually assaulting a 17-year-old girl. She had allegedly been trafficked by Jeffrey Epstein. The school is looking for name suggestions. Its principal, Greg Campbell, says he'd like a name that matches the school's values of positivity, support, and respect.
It's been a week since the province announced a new child care agreement. Many private daycare owners are still trying to figure out how it will affect their businesses. The changes have some parents worried. Gabrielle Brunette reports.
Today's announcement is all about parents, families, and Nova Scotia's youngest citizens.
We signed a historic deal with Nova Scotia to make childcare more affordable.
Childcare costs are a barrier for so many families.
Significant announcement for families and children.
Last Friday, the province announced that childcare costs are being reduced by 25% this month and 50% by the end of this year. These changes are part of a Canada-wide agreement to provide $10 a day childcare on average by 2026. But for private daycares like Brightside Early Learning Center in Cole Harbour, this comes at a cost. Losing their funding or giving up control over the number of spaces and wait lists, for example. And that's worrying parents too. Matt Archer has two kids, including a four-year-old, who's still at Brightside.
I know the director there, Aaron, has worked so hard to create that product. And to hear that it's basically going to be taken away from her is just, it's devastating. Brightside won't be Brightside anymore.
Childcare centers are presented with three options. They can opt out of the Canada-wide plan and lose funding, become nonprofit, or become an approved service provider, which allows them to remain private, but lose some control over operations. Lisa Beto operates 420 spaces with over 80 employees, and she says the options daycares have been presented with are unfair.
These are daycares that have been started up 30, 40 years ago, predominantly women, female entrepreneurs in the province that have started this up and have put a lot of effort into building their business.
Valley Godso works for Beto as an early childhood educator, or ECE, with Friends for Life. She believes in affordable childcare, just not the way the province is going about it.
We want to be able to find a solution that gives parents $10 a day daycare while supporting the private sector and not forcing them to give up everything that they've worked towards and that benefits the ECEs within the field as well.
Beto says if daycares choose to remain private and not take government funding, they'll be forced to raise prices to remain in business. And that puts them at risk of shutting down. Back at Brightside, Archer says their daycare is really a second home.
You know, the relationships we built at that one daycare, I can imagine there's thousands of families who built very similar relationships where they are.
Daycare owners originally had until March 18th to decide whether or not to become part of the daycare funding agreement. However, Premier Houston has since announced that the deadline will be extended. Gabrielle Brunette, The Signal, Halifax.
You're listening to The Signal on CKDU 88.1 FM in Halifax and at Signal HFX on Twitter. You can also hear us on SoundCloud. Just search King's Radio Room.
We're bringing you stories from the audio workshop at the University of King's College School of Journalism. I'm Drew McConnell.
And I'm Sarah Krimilewski. Still to come on the show, our feature interview with one of the authors of the report on defunding the police in Halifax.
But what we've done instead is we've said, every single social problem, let's devote those resources to the police because they'll deal with it. And what ends up happening is that, quite frankly, they do not.
We'll hear from Tari Anjadi right ahead.
And Nova Scotians paid tribute to former NDP leader Alexa McDonough this week. A doctor who was part of her care team talks about the looming threat of Alzheimer's to our healthcare system.
In the summer of 2020, Halifax activists campaigned to defund the police. This week, almost 2 years later, Halifax has a report on what defunding means to Haligonians and how to put those ideas into action. Tari Anjadi is one of the main co-authors of the report, along with Elle Jones, Harry Critchley, and Julia Rogers. He spoke with The Signal's John Marshall.
So welcome to The Signal, Mr. Anjadi. This report is titled Defunding the Police. Could you elaborate a bit on what that means exactly?
If we really want to drill down to the kind of core ethic of this report, it's that we have faith in our community that we can keep each other safe. Defunding the police here refers to a complex interweb of how we might reimagine community safety. So it's not simply taking money or taking funds away from police forces, but it's also about reinvesting that money into broad-based models of community safety that don't rely on enforcement and violence to help support all of us, particularly those of us who are marginalized within our community. And it's been the community that's delivered this report. It's been the community that has been the engine of this whole initiative. And so that's where we're really coming from as we produce this report.
What would happen what will happen in the case of violent crimes or property crime?
Right. So there's three kind of major points here. The first is that there's no evidence whatsoever that suggests that police presence automatically reduces violent crime. Thing number two is that the report is not calling for abolition, right? There is a role, at least for the medium term, for a police force in Halifax Regional Municipality. It's just that role needs to be brought down to scope, it needs to be specified, and it needs to be, in many ways, confined to those relatively rare incidences of violent crime. The third thing is that actually violent crime in Halifax has been decreasing for years now. What we're trying to say is that the roots of violent crime are often complex social factors that have to do with marginalization, that have to do with poverty, that have to do with the lack of resources and needs being met within communities across our municipality. And so can we address those needs? Can we meet people where they are and try to get them to a place where they have many of those needs met, and then think about what we do once that's happened? But what we've done instead is we've said, every single social problem, let's devote those resources to the police because they'll deal with it. And what ends up happening is that, quite frankly, they do not.
You kind of hinted a little bit with your answer there, saying that the community was what brought this report forward. But could you speak a bit to how the subcommittee was formed? And
right, okay. So there was extensive advocacy from many individuals in the community following the death of George Floyd, Chantel Moore, Regis Korchinski-Paquette, and many others who've been killed at the hands of police officers across North America. So after an extensive effort by a group called the Nova Scotia Policing Policy Working Group, among many others, and spoiler, I'm one of the co-founders of that group alongside many other people, we pushed the Halifax Board of Police Commissioners to strike a subcommittee to quote-unquote defunding the police. So we got together and put together a public survey where we received 2,351 survey responses. We held a 6-hour long public consultation session with 19 different presentations. We had written submissions coming from community groups across the city. We engaged with the National Police Foundation. So it really was a fulsome community effort and something that, you know, was one of the greatest experiences of my life, I can say for sure.
And you'd say of the 36 recommendations, they do represent the community response?
Absolutely. So the really interesting thing about the survey was that even those who vehemently opposed defunding, those who really had nothing good to say about the issue, because let's be very clear, it's very politicized, right? It's something that people have very strong opinions about. They would say, we hate defunding, this is a radical Marxist attempt to blah, 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 blah. But also, police officers shouldn't be doing mental health calls, or police officers are really stretched out and overstretched, or police officers, we need better traffic lights in our community. We need more street lighting in our community. And then they go back to saying something kind of very like, defunding is an awful thing to do. And that's fine. You don't have to like defunding. That's totally okay. We wanted to reflect the community opinion genuinely. But what we found is that, ignore the title for a minute. Police officers shouldn't be going to mental health calls. Well, yeah, we happen to agree, right? Like there's a broad consensus on that particular issue. So there's actually a moderate level of consensus about what it is that we've put in the report. Not everyone's going to agree on everything, but it's abundantly clear. Decades of austerity by municipal, provincial, and federal governments has meant that our social safety net has been eviscerated. We need to build that back up. We can all agree on that. As for what should be done about the police, I have particular views about that. It seems that about 1,300 of our participants have particular views about that. And I think that that's where we're going to disagree, but I think it's also important to engage the views that we don't agree with seriously.
Yeah, I think the mental health aspect is really, it's really important. Could you maybe elaborate just a little bit more on some of the findings and like how it fits into your report?
Right. So yeah, as I mentioned, the impression that we got from the coding across the board was that there was a broad consensus at the idea that police should not be tasked to do wellness checks, should not be tasked to do mental health work, that in fact, it's people that should be, that are equipped to do that kind of intervention that should be tasked with doing that work. We could add in peer support, we could add in trained counselors, trained nurses, etc. And they would be the first line of response. Similarly, we can think about issues to do with traffic calming, to do with speeding, to do with traffic and road safety. There was broad agreement that our roads need to be safer. But we can do that in a variety of ways, and not least of which is building our infrastructure so that it's not hostile to pedestrians and cyclists and other active transportation users. We don't have to have four-lane highways going through our city. Those are not navigatable. Those incentivize people speeding. That, too, is defunding. So those are just a couple of examples here.
Yeah, that's something a lot of people wouldn't consider, like defunding could speak more broadly to a shift away from being car focused into being more pedestrian and people focused. Since the report has been published and presented to the board, could you maybe tell me how people have been responding?
So far, the reception has been overwhelmingly positive, and it's been really heartening to see. We've had a lot of response from community that's been very, very positive. But that's not enough. So the report has been published. We've presented it to the Board of Police Commissioners. There is still hanging over our heads right now a $2 million budget increase potentially for the Halifax Regional Police. If the Board of Police Commissioners passes that $2 million increase, it would be a slap in the face to every single community member who contributed to this report. And so it's really important that the community turns out to the public meeting that was just passed in the Board of Police Commissioners meeting. It's really important that they give their input. And if they are against the idea of increasing the budget of the police, that is the unwritten 37th recommendation. That is the piece that they need to address, right? Like, that is priority number one. We cannot give them any more money. Even though the police are the only body in our society that have a monopoly on the use of the legitimate form of violence, we are still governed by consent. We still have a voice, we still have a say, and it's so important that we use that voice to reshape our city.
I really appreciate you for speaking with us on The Signal today. It was really
Thanks
interesting.
For having me on. Appreciate yeah, it. No Thank problem. You so much.
Hari Ajadi is one of the main authors of the report on defunding the police that came out this week. He was speaking with John Marshall.
January is Alzheimer's Awareness Month in Canada. In Nova Scotia this year, it has more significance after the recent loss of former provincial and federal NDP leader Alexa McDonough to the disease. More than 500,000 Canadians suffer from the illness, with about 76,000 new cases reported every year. Unlike COVID-19, this illness doesn't come in waves, but in one progressive tsunami that threatens to swallow the healthcare system whole.
Will this government set targets and timetables to fix the EI system? And if not, will they admit that they have simply given up on those who desperately need their help?
Alexa McDonough was as sharp-tongued as she was sharp-witted. That wit and her famous tenacity led her to become the first woman to lead a political party in Canadian history. McDonough passed away last weekend at the age of 77. Like many people with Alzheimer's, she faded out from her public life. Linda Bird is the Director of Programs and Services with the Alzheimer's Society of Nova Scotia. She says many people resist help.
Like other mental health issues, there's a lot of stigma associated with, there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of misunderstanding, a lot of myths. And I think the best thing people can do is become informed.
The Alzheimer's Society offers many programs to help people through their Alzheimer's diagnosis. But Bird says more help is needed because of a rise in patient numbers.
One organization can't do it alone. So what would, you know, we need dementia-friendly, inclusive communities, exercise programs that people can attend, different types of programs to keep them intellectually and physically stimulated.
Bird says 17,000 Nova Scotians suffer from the disease, and that number will double over the next 10 years. That's driving a shift in research from focusing solely on treatment to now looking at ways of preventing the illness. Dr. Kenneth Rockwood is an Alzheimer's researcher and professor at Dalhousie University. He was on Alexa McDonough's care team. He says Canada has a long way to go in tackling the Alzheimer's problem, and it starts with research investments.
The U.S. spends $3.2 billion. Canada, if you take a very, very, very generous definition of it, probably around $30 million. So we're massively per capita outspent.
Along with the insufficient funding, Rockwood says our healthcare system, already stretched beyond capacity, will see a huge influx of dementia patients.
Every year we're increasing to unprecedented levels. The number of people between the ages of 75 and 90, we will have unprecedented levels of dementia. That's a fact.
Rockwood says that his fear is that government will spend money on things like building new nursing homes without investing properly in preventative measures. He says this strategy could have catastrophic consequences.
We will lose our ability for publicly funded medical care if we don't figure out a better way to do what we're doing. And the public sector, perversely, through this lack of investment, will be left with an ever larger burden of people with multiple interacting medical and social problems, including dementia.
Despite this dire warning, Linda Bird remains optimistic about the future. She cites the work researchers are doing on possible medications and says the provincial dementia strategy is progressing. And she says groups like the Alzheimer's Society are making it easier for patients to get help.
I think that young women mistakenly believe that equality is here.
All of which the late Alexa McDonough would fiercely advocate for with passion and conviction. For The Signal, I'm Drew McConnell in Halifax.
That's our show for today.
If there's anything you want to hear again, we post links to our stories on Twitter. Our handle is SignalHFX.
Thanks to our producer, Gabrielle Brunet.
And our shout out to our technician, the remarkable Mark Pinio in the control room.
Our audio professor is Pauline Dakin. I'm Sarah Krumalowski.
And I'm Drew McConnell. We'll be back next week with more stories. Have a great weekend.